This is the Biochem 421 lecture for October
27, 2009. All right, well, anyway, this is a lecture for October 28, and we're dealing with 27. Yes, sorry. I looked there and tomorrow, 28 tomorrow. And this is actually dealing with chapter number 12 and chapter number 13. And I presume you have chapter 13 already printed off for yourselves. Is that right? No? That's okay. Because I anticipated your tardiness. And I've got the first 24 pages printed off for you. Although they're not here because I myself was tardy. They're up at the duplicator office. So when we get done here with chapter 12... I'll have Christina run up to the duplicator and get the copies. Christiana. Who keeps saying Christina? Christiana. Okay. Christiana Amanpour. All right. So, here we go. This is the polymerase chain reaction. We went through this process. What in the world is in those little vials there that they do this polymerase chain reaction in? What's in there? What's the enzyme that's in there? In a polymerase chain reaction, what's in it? TAQ. T-A-Q. Now, what kind of enzyme is it? Is it a metabolizing? I mean, is it a carbohydrate metabolizing enzyme? It's a what? DNA polymerase. All right. What else is in this? What else is in here? DNA of interest. Typically, it's the... It's a broad span. It contains more than just your DNA of interest that you want to amplify. What else does it have? This is, by the way, the double-stranded form of it. What else is in there? Primers. I think I heard somebody say primers. That's exactly right. This is, of course, to start the DNA, start the polymerase. And what else is it for? Select the segment. All right, and then there may be some other, there's probably some ions and some buffers and other stuff in it, but what's the last thing that's probably in there then? Yeah. DNTP. And of course, when I see N, what do I mean? Any of the four. Is that correct? All right, so you got the DNA, it comes in there. You got the targeted sequence. You come in there, and it comes in as a double strand. The first thing they have to do is what? Yeah, take the double strand and make it into a single strand. How do you do that? Heat it, and then what happens? As you begin to cool it, what happens? The primers then anneal to the appropriate segment. The primers are in a 1,000-fold excess. So you got a 1,000-fold concentration of primers more than what you need. Because do you reuse the primers? Where are the primers? What do they end up being incorporated in? Complementary to the thing, exactly. Then they cool it again, the primers anneal, and then what happens? The TAG DNA polymerase does what? What's the polymerase do then to that single-stranded DNA that has a primer attached to it? Yeah, it duplicates the double strand. Then what happens again? The heated, cool to 70, more primers anneal to it. The polymerase takes off. They heat it again, separates, begin to cool it, the primer attaches. And so here you have, just after three or four steps, you have got an exponential increase in the amount of duplicated DNA. Very, very powerful method for amplifying DNA. This is used by many forensics labs that do this kind of thing. The old DNA that was hardly detectable 20 years ago is now detectable, and they can amplify it using this method. And there are people who are being captured and put in prison for crimes that they've committed a long time ago that the statute of limitations has not run out on, which is rape and murder. And so they're capturing all kinds of people with this. You need to know this pretty well. You need to know it pretty well, whether you're a biologist or a chemist. Read what they say in the textbook, and I'm going to ask you some penetrating questions about it to test your knowledge. Some what ifs. Yes, Mr. Graves.
How do you know where it stops?
Well, the first time it stops, it runs on past the primer sequence. The very first time. How can I describe it? So the primer adds this region and that region, and the DNA polymerase goes on and runs past the end, as it were. But as it does that, it duplicates the region that's going to be the home for the next cycle's primer. And so it ends up that after the first sequence, it simply runs from one primer to the next, from the starting primer to the other primer end on the DNA sequence. And so the primers begin to limit where the DNA runs. Does that make any sense at all? No. Does everybody understand his question? Where does it know to quit? All right, well, that's an excellent question. I have had that answer before, and I'm going to have to reproduce it because it's not right on the tip of my tongue. All right, well, let's see here. How can I do this? I'm going to make this horizontal. We're going to have some DNA right here, double-stranded DNA. The region that we want to duplicate is right here. And the primer set is right here. Okay? That's the primer set. That's the primer that it tags. And so if we separate it. Is that correct? We separate it. And we get this. And we get this. And the first time, so this is where the primer begins. The first time the DNA runs, it duplicates, oh boy, all right. Do I have any colored chalk? At one time I did. Oh, look at this. Look at this pink. I've never seen a prettier pink. And so the daughter strands then become this. Would you agree that the daughter strands become this? Yes, indeed. All right. Well, then what do? We re-anneal that again, is that correct? I mean, we separate it again. And so what do we got? We got four strands, and we got two single strands of this. Okay, would you agree? Now, these are all separated, right? Where's the primer going to anneal there? Here. Where's the primer going to anneal? Hold on. I want to make this absolutely correct. One of these actually stops right here. Would you agree? And the other one, because that's where the primer began, and the other one, oh, come on, stops right here, as it were. So this one stops right here, and this one stops. So what happens is then, The next time we do this, the primers will automatically anneal right here and right here. And so what happens is that after the first cycle, the segment that's being amplified is bounded by the primers. We constantly, this one is all, these two are always there, but pretty soon with the amplification process, only those strands that begin and end exactly at the primer location will be duplicated. And so you'll have a 10,000 to 1 preponderance of the exact primer to primer duplication relative to the extended original DNA. Was that helpful? Kind of. Because what happens is that the first time it runs through the complete sequence, but it duplicates the daughter primer sequence. And that's where the primer on the next heating plate is going to begin. And so you end up limiting the vast majority of amplifications to from primer to primer. Because the daughter sequence will have the primer for the original duplex on the other side, as it were. That's how that works. Let me investigate that a little bit more, and maybe I can come up with a diagram that would be more helpful. Okay? But that's an excellent question. Yep. How do you know where it ends? And that's just the kind of question you're liable to find on MCAT-type score, MCAT-type test, although most of you have done that, or DAT. Now, PCR-based directed mutagenesis, do you see this figure here? Do you have it? Yeah, we're going to skip it. Okay. Good. Now, Miss Markovic, would you run upstairs quickly to the duplicating room, and there should be a whole stack of Chapter 13 handouts there in the duplicator if they've not been moved already. La dee 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 dee. Finally, we're getting out of that DNA forest. I like DNA. I have DNA myself, actually. But I'm not all that. I'm just not a gene jock. Sorry. Just not a gene jock. I like it. I can do it. Just not a big fan of it. Anyway, I am a big fan of this stuff, though. This is more fun than you can shake a stick at, assuming that you're not asleep from exhaustion. All right, so I went to bed. Hold it. Since we have two people, I went to bed last night at 9:30.
What?
9:30. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I woke up at 3:30 and got up and did about an hour and a half to 2 hours worth of work. And then I went back to bed for another hour and then got up. So I probably got about as much sleep as you guys did. It just did it in bizarre times. Okay.
What?
Did you? Well, you were up pretty late last night? Since we're waiting, Dave Novak. No, you have the right number. We share a cell, and I have it today. I can't talk now. I'll have her give you a call when I see her. Is that okay? Well, she's at work right now. And basically, she'll be at work all day. I will leave a message at home. So the first opportunity she might have would be probably noon. Would that be soon enough? Okay. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Okay. All right. Hope you don't mind me taking that phone call. All right. What characteristic features define enzymes, ladies and gentlemen? And Christiana is passing that out right now, and there should be enough for everybody. Please don't hog any. Don't take two or three to be selfish. Yeah?
Is there just as much tack as there is primers?
No, there's only a few hundred tack.
So tack is being reused?
Tack is being reused and reused and reused. Exactly right. It's actually a question. The relative proportion of tack here is there's not that many. There's maybe a few hundred tack. Why is there a few hundred, only a few hundred tack? Because why? They're being reused. Well, how can they withstand the heating and cooling cycle Yes, it is. Yeah, well, because the tack, of course, is thermally stable, as Gretchen's pointing out. So you can, since it's being reused, the enzyme, you know, don't need that many molecules in it. All right, so enzyme kinetics and specificity. Do you have that there? Excellent, let's go ahead. Enzymes endow cells with remarkable capacity to exert kinetic control over thermodynamic potentiality. Oh my goodness, again, that's a phrase right there that indicates that you guys are in college, okay? The reading level of that particular sentence is fairly high, given all the syllables and stuff in it. The enzymes endow cells with remarkable capacity and exert kinetic control over thermodynamic potentiality. What does that mean, ladies and gentlemen? Well, do you remember the reaction potential here, energy, and this is... Oh, that's really bad. This is ATP. This is ATP here. And this is ADP plus PI. Okay? There's a huge... This is the delta H here, or actually the delta G is very, very large for the hydrolysis of ATP. Why doesn't it occur spontaneously? Why, if it's such a large exothermic reaction, why doesn't it occur spontaneously? Well, it will, but you have to understand that delta G says nothing about enzyme rate. Okay? Thermodynamic stability says nothing about how fast it'll occur. Okay? The rusting of a car or steel is highly exothermic, but it's not going to occur instantaneously. Or can you imagine what would happen if you got a scratch in your car? And the energy of activation for rust was very low. You'd scratch it, and within a few days or less, your car would be a pile of rust, just sitting there with tires around it. And but that's not the way so thermodynamic potentiality. So the thermodynamic potentiality is the thermodynamics. But what's that kinetic control? Well, this is the kinetic control. The E energy of activation is the kinetic control. That's what. So enzymes modify that kinetic control. ATP you can have in your body for weeks, years, theoretically, although it's highly recycled. But the molecule itself, as ATP, is highly stable. It's a high energy, highly stable compound. It takes an enzyme to lower the energy of activation to release that potentiality. That's why it says kinetic control. Enzymes are the agents of metabolic function. We would not exist without enzymes, ladies and gentlemen. We are. The genius of life is enzymes. The genius of life, truly, is enzymes. What is it about enzymes? Important differences compared to inorganic catalysts. Higher rates of reaction. Milder reaction conditions. Atmospheric pressure. Water-based, neutral pH, all these are important reaction conditions. Greater substrate specificity. Capacity for regulation. In other words, this is not a mindless catalysis. You can control it. Matter of fact, you must control it, for control is life. When we begin to talk about enzymes, ladies and gentlemen, when we begin to talk about enzymes, you and their regulation, it becomes clear as to why I've asked you to memorize all those pathways. Because I don't have time to talk about the pathway itself. I want to talk about the regulation of the pathway and the specific enzymes that are regulated within that pathway. And when I can talk about regulation, I'm talking about life. You'll find that most diseases that you find in your work as a physician or dentist, or in most of your work perhaps as a biologist grad students or biochemical or chemical grad students, are going to deal with disease states that have to do with the malregulation of an enzyme. The malregulation of an enzyme. The vast majority of diseases are due to that. Milder reaction conditions. You are exist at atmospheric pressure. You're water-based. How many organic reactions did you do in organic chemistry that were in water? Or did you use a lot of organic solvents? Right. Well, all those, many of those chemical reactions that you used in a solvent occur in a water-based solution. That's yours. Those type of reactions, at least. And that's because an enzyme is there to help it along. And at neutral pH, amazing. A neutral pH. All right. Greater substrate specificity. They're enzymes. There are literally hundreds, thousands of small molecules in your cell. And an enzyme can pick one molecule out of it, make a transformation, and produce a specific product from that one molecule that it picks out of a whole raft of other molecules. Okay? Imagine this entire room full of people. And imagine a glove. And that glove has to find the one hand in this whole room of people that it fits perfectly. And it has to find it almost immediately. And when that transformation, when that glove fits, it performs a transformation that produces a specific product, a specific shape of hand, perhaps. And it has to do that 100% correctly, day after day after day, until itself is worn out. Well, how do you know it's worn out? Well, another enzyme detects it being worn out. All right, so that's what it is. And again, the regulation, there's allosteric regulation. This means conformational control. Conformation. In other words, that there's the allosteric means there is a subtle shift in shape. A subtle shift in shape is what allosteric control is. Most of the regulation of enzymes that exist in your body are either going to be this allosteric control, especially for metabolism, or covalent modification. That's typically where you put a phosphate. Phosphating an enzyme or a protein is a very common and important method of doing this. Covalent modification means there has to be an enzyme to add the phosphate. There also has to be an enzyme to remove the phosphate. Because one of the fundamental rules of metabolism is if you have a way to turn something on, you must also have a way to do what?
Turn it off.
So whenever you're looking at a new process or something, and you can see that the person is talking about turning this on, the next question is, how does it turn it off? If they don't tell you how it's turned off, you need to ask. Okay? If you turn something on, the body has to figure out a way to turn it off. And sometimes the disease is not turning on is bad. Sometimes the disease is turning off is bad. An amount of enzyme is available. That's probably true, especially for development. This is especially true in bacteria. They can quickly make new enzymes given the opportunity. You're familiar with the lac operon. Is that correct? At least the ones that are biologists. That lac operon can produce proteins almost within seconds after the detection of lactose. Now, what happens is that enzymes also require something known as cofactors. The cofactor can be small molecules required to participate, molecules or ions required to participate in enzyme transformations. You also have two other phrases here. Holoenzyme and apoenzyme that you need to be familiar with. Holoenzyme and apoenzyme. All right, let's go through here. The term cofactor is a general term. A cofactor typically is thought of as being an ion. A cofactor is an inorganic kind of substituent. A coenzyme is a subclass of cofactor that's specifically related to small organic molecules. So a coenzyme, small organic molecules. A prosthetic group is also a type of cofactor. Small covalently bound factor, heme. is the common one. Hemoglobin. Hemoglobin. The globin part of hemoglobin is protein. The heme part is this prosthetic group. A holoenzyme is a complete functional enzyme. An apoenzyme is enzyme minus its cofactor. Minus its cofactor. Many of the cofactors, however, are related to vitamins. And we'll go through that in a little bit. Here are a list of common cofactors. Do you have that list there? Yes, and I have not blocked it out, have I? Wonderful. I want you to... I don't know. I can't. We can't skip it because the standardized test had this stuff on here. Checkmark biotin. Checkmark cobalamin, vitamin B12. Checkmark coenzyme A. Checkmark flavin. Nicotinamide. Tetrahydrofolate and thiamine pyrophosphate. I know, it's all but two of them, I guess, isn't it? Yeah, sorry. But it just cannot be helped. Biotin is a vital coenzyme. A vital coenzyme. Obviously, cobalamin, vitamin B12, important. There's only three reactions in your body. Actually, three reactions in nature in which vitamin B12 is even used. But those three happen to be very, very, very important and are not substituted by any other kind of thing. The amount of vitamin B12 you use every day is in the nanogram quantities. If you have a good diet, which you do, and you don't have a disease, you probably have 4 to 6 years worth of vitamin B12 in your body just stored. That even if you today stopped importing vitamin B12 into your body, you wouldn't notice any symptoms for 4 to 12 years. The flavin, the nicotinamide, those are all oxidation reduction. You'll find those a lot in the electron transport system. Tetrahydrofolate, one carbon transfers for synthesis. And thiamine pyrophosphate aldehyde transfers. Now, the lack of some of these provides disease states. For example, biotin, biocytin is the coenzyme. The vitamin is biotin. Biocytin is the coenzyme. If you're eating at all, you're getting enough biocytin. Matter of fact, the bacteria that you swallow in your mouth is enough to give enough biocytin. So if you're biocytin. Cobalamin, vitamin B12, B12 coenzymes, that's pernicious anemia. I need for you to know the vitamin and the disease state. Cobalamin, and vitamin, the coenzyme, and the disease state. Folic acid, tetrahydrofolate, megaloblastic anemia. Nicotinamide coenzymes, pellagra. And thiamine, vitamin B12 is beriberi. But there are other vitamins you have to have. Pantothenate, peroxidine, riboflavin, B6, B2, B1, B12. But these are so rare that they simply only have discovered them when they were feeding rats a diet deficient in these compounds. Because if you're eating at all, like I said, if you're eating at all, you're getting enough of these to survive. That's not the case with the ones that have a disease state. Let's see here. Pellagra. Folic acid. Tetrahydrofolate, the deficiency in pregnant women, can produce a specific developmental disease called spina bifida. But we'll talk about tetrahydrofolate. Fascinating chemistry with tetrahydrofolate. And what does tetrahydrofolate do? What does it do? One carbon group transfers. So do you see what I'm going to ask you to know? The disease state is pernicious anemia. The coenzyme that's missing is cobalamin, and cobalamin deals with alkylation. So pernicious anemia has a problem with alkylation. That's the kind of connection I want you to make between those two charts. Does that make sense? All righty, let's go ahead, shall we? I need for you to know these classifications very simply. These are easy to know. Different kinds of enzymes, oxidoreductases, transferases, hydrolases, lyases, isomerases, ligases. There's another one that's not listed here. Would you put down epimerases? E-P-I-M-E-R-A-S-E, epimerases. E-P-I-M-E-R-A-S-E, epimerase. What do you think a epimerase does? Right, switches the configuration around a specific stereocenter. Switches the configuration around a specific stereocenter. Ligases form bonds. Isomerases, isomers. Oxidoreductases, oxidation reduction reactions. Transferases, of course you can understand this. These names you'll need to know. Here is what the big deal is about enzymes. And why this says what it says here at the beginning. At the very beginning, kinetic control over thermodynamic potentiality. Is there a good potential here? Good thermodynamic potential. Is there? Does this appear to occur? Would this occur according to the delta G? Would this occur spontaneously? Yes, absolutely. So, in the presence of oxygen, why doesn't glucose just spontaneously begin to burn? Activation energy is so high. Exactly correct. Why do you put sodium in the presence of water? Why does it spontaneously react? Well, obviously, the thermodynamic potential is there, but also what? Very low kinetic barrier. In other words, there's virtually no kinetic, there's no energy of activation between the reactants and the product. So here what you have, an uncatalyzed potential energy of activation is very high. But the energy of activation with enzymes, which provides a different pathway, lowers it and thus enables it to occur probably at room temperature, atmospheric pressure. But the energy of activation with the enzyme, the key there is that's controllable. I can turn that enzyme on or off. I can make that active or inactive. All right, you see this chart. I don't want you to know much of it. Actually, I don't need to know. You don't need to know any of it. This is just a handy table. You know that the idea here is that metal ions are an important part. I don't know why they threw this in at this point, but anyway, I should put this in different order. The metal ions here are also an important part of some of the cofactors. So metal ion is a cofactor. The coenzyme is an organic material related to the same idea as a cofactor. It's required, but not there. So notice, magnesium is required for hexokinase and so on. So this is just an idea. Look at all the different metal ions that are required. Selenium, molybdenum, manganese, magnesium, zinc, copper, iron, obviously. All right, so that was out of place, and I apologize for that. Specificity. Enzymes selectively recognize proper substrates over other molecules. That is a crucial pair. That's a crucial piece of information about enzymes. Produce products in very high yield, often as much as greater than 95%. How many organic reactions, when you took organic and measured the yield rate, were 95% or higher? How many? Any of them? Ken, do you remember any that you got 95% or higher yield? No? Yeah, it got pretty high. I've gotten 90% or higher on a Diels-Alder reaction. You've heard of Diels-Alder? Yeah, Diels-Alder. Is that what you're working on today? Oh, Diels-Alder. But that's because, it's basically this. You put two materials together, the orbitals rotate, and bingo, you got the product. Not much to it, but that's pretty unusual for organic reactions. Specificity is controlled by the structure. The unique fit of the substrate with the enzyme controls the selectivity substrate and the product yield. The product yield. All right, so structure, the structure-function relationship. This has to do not merely with the configuration of the enzyme, but its conformation. Its conformation. For example, if I was to, I want to be careful here and not, if I was to shake, you don't have a computer here, do you? Okay, good. If I was to shake your hand, all right, notice how nicely it fits. Exactly right. See, now then, I want you to, however, in addition, I want you to hold your pen. All right, now notice. Ooh. All right, no, notice, that's fine. Notice, would it fit as well with that pen attached to it? No. No, really, I mean, no. Look at this. Look at this. See how nicely it fits? Yeah, see, pardon me, can I remove your arm? I need to show everybody. Anyway, so that would be a configuration change and not a conformational change. Anyway, so notice the conformation fits so nicely. I put a pen there, and go ahead and hold the pen appropriately. There you go, and now shake my hand. Notice how it does not fit nearly as well. Now notice, have I changed the configuration of her hand? No. Have I broken any bonds? No. I've simply changed the shape for the presence of a small molecule. That small molecule can consider to be a regulatory molecule. The presence of that regulatory molecule alters the conformation of the molecule and thus the effectiveness of how well we shake hands. That's where it says the unique fit of substrate with enzyme controls the selectivity of the substrate and product yield. So, having a small molecule that can change the conformation, is that... Am I describing allosteric control or covalent modification? Allosteric. Because I've not permanently attached that pen to her hand, right? So if I simply took her hand and jammed the pen through it, you don't mind, do you? Yeah, no, why not? I get healed, don't you? At any rate, that might be a configuration change, which would be a covalent modification, but it wouldn't be very good, and I would probably be fired. At any rate, so here's substrate. Substrate specificity can be thought of in two major areas, as you see listed here, stereospecificity and geometric specificity. Stereospecificity and geometric specificity. The stereospecificity literally deals with the handedness of it. The geometric specificity is much more complicated and deals with forces besides just the shape. I need a pen that's got a cap. Anybody got a pen with a cap? Just real quick. Do I have one? Oh, wonderful. A marker. Perfect. All right. So may I borrow your hand again? Notice, however, if we're going to shake hands, notice how the stereospecificity works well. Right-handed fits nicely with the what? Right. Right-handed. Not a problem. Easily change conformation. Now, however, the geometric specificity deals with forces other than just the shape. For example, if buried in her active site was this cap, and I, on my other hand, we had the right stereospecificity, but we do not have the right forces that would connect well. They might fit in, but they are not a good fit, are they? For example. That's really a bad example. I'll just do this. All right, here we go. Right-handed, the stereospecificity. Will that additional force then help hold the two pieces together? No. If, however, I was like this, right? No, and we shake hands very nicely. The additional specificity that can be obtained by forces other than just shape provides additional layer. Thank you very much. Provides additional layer for this. So what kind of forces can you identify here? What are you looking for here? Can you identify some forces? You've got, before the bond, you have a plus, a minus, and a plus charge. That would be a what? Force other than shape. Name the force where it's a plus and minus charge in a protein. Salt bridges. Write down salt bridges. Notice the nitrogen, hydrogen, and the oxygen down here. That dashed line and this dashed line over here. What kind of force would that be? Hydrogen bonding. Okay. What about the hydrophobic interactions here and the hydrophobic interactions here? Well, I bet you they would be what? Hydrophobic interactions. Okay. Now, what force that holds proteins together is missing from this? What was it? Van der Waals. Actually, that would be a part of the hydrophobic. disulfide bonds, because that's a none of these are strong enough to be considered to be a covalent or ionic bond. They're forces, but they're not bonds, except the hydrogen bond, which is misnamed. So there's no disulfide bond here because this interaction is temporary. It's only a change in shape. Right? This is an allosteric effect. And we will then finish this. So thank you very much today, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you on the morrow.